The sermon today is a little bit different, perhaps, from most of the sermons I'm giving. You will see in a moment why that is, because I try to put a little bit of humor in a perhaps otherwise rather explosive topic. Because the title of the sermon is Balanced Christian Living. You see, as Christians, as followers of Jesus Christ, we have to have a sound mind. I mean, it does talk about the fact that we have been given a spirit of a sound mind, which means it's a balanced mind. It's not an extreme mind. It's not a mind which is extreme either on the right or on the left. You see, God tells us time and time again, this is the way, that way you go, neither go to the left nor go to the right. You know, I've seen over the years, and I'm sure you have, extremely right-winged ministers and members. But then when the flood of changes came in the worldwide Church of God, many of those extremely right-winged people became extremely left-winged. That is, from a pharisaically, quote-unquote, upholding every jot and tittle of the law, they came to believe that there was no law anymore. With the law is dead movement, they brought unspeakable misery upon themselves and upon their loved ones. The point is, they were extreme. They were unbalanced. They never seemed to have had a sound mind, neither before the changes came or after the changes came. See, it's very important, brethren, that we are balanced, sound-minded people. Once in a while, Mr. Armstrong would say something out loud, and there were always ministers who jumped on every word that he said as the infallible gospel truth. And then they applied what he might have said in thinking out loud to the extreme. When Mr. Armstrong heard that, he would say, aren't there any ministers out there with common sense? It seemed like there weren't that many there with common sense. He would say, that's not what I meant. Although he might have said it in a certain way, but that's not what I meant. Aren't there any people out there with common sense? He would say time and again. Please look at Ecclesiastes chapter 7 with me for a moment as an introduction. Ecclesiastes chapter 7. And let's notice what we are being told here in verses 16 to 18. Ecclesiastes chapter 7, beginning in verse 16. It's good admonition to all of us. Do not be, or other translations have here, don't behave overly righteous, nor be overly wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Do not be overly wicked, nor be foolish. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you grasp this, and also not remove your hand from the other. For he who fears God will escape them all. You see, again, we need to have the right kind of balance. Now, I realize there are some, or there have been some, perhaps liberal ministers who have used the word balance. And what they meant by that is, oh, we can compromise with God's law. And, of course, that is a totally wrong approach, because then it becomes an unbalanced, extreme standpoint. But the fact that some have abused the word, it's not going to prevent me from using the word in the right context and in the right sense. And what I'd like to do today is to give a few examples of how to look at certain aspects of Christian living with the right kind of balance. Now, there are many examples I could give. I just decided to give five to discuss five topics. Again, we can't be like the Pharisees who created rules and regulations like a fence, like a wall, so that one couldn't get to the heart and the core of the commandments. For instance, they created all kinds of rules and regulations regarding the Sabbath. They were nowhere contained in the Bible, but they thought they had to do that because in order to get to the core and the heart of the Sabbath command, you first have to kind of breach and break and violate those rules they had created. So they thought, well, you'll never get to the point when you break the Sabbath command, because you have to go through that fence, that wall they had built around it. But the problem is, Christ said, in doing that, they have put a yoke on the people which the people couldn't bear. They totally violated the spirit of the Sabbath commandment in creating those rules, because the Sabbath was supposed to give us joy. The Sabbath was supposed to give us rest and peace, but it had become a burden. And so, based on that concept, let's talk a little bit about a few concepts, about a few ideas or topics. Now, I'd also like to mention to you that I'm going to give you a test at the end of the sermon with certain questions. It's going to be true and false questions. And I expect you to answer the questions correctly, because if you don't, you haven't listened. And then I have to give you an assignment as to what you need to do. Issue number one. It happens to start with an A, that's why it's the first on the topic of the list here. Alcohol. What about alcohol? Now, some don't drink any alcohol for several reasons. Now, if someone is a recovering alcoholic, then he mustn't drink, because it is so important that somebody who has been an alcoholic and tries to recover doesn't fall back into that trap of alcoholism. You've probably heard about famous actors and singers like David Hasselhoff or Glenn Campbell who have been recovering alcoholics, but then they slipped and got to the point they drank one drop and it led to more alcoholism. Until finally, in case of Glenn Campbell, he didn't even know what he was doing. And he was driving a car and found himself later in the cell, in a jail, the next day, and he was interviewed, and he said, I have absolutely no memory what happened. So it's important, of course, if you are a recovering alcoholic, or anybody who is, that he shouldn't or mustn't drink. But if, on the other hand, the reason for not drinking alcohol is the fear that when one starts to drink a little, you know, alcoholic beverages, one will automatically become an alcoholic, then that is an unbalanced approach. You know, we had in this country at one time the famous prohibition, where no one was allowed to buy or to drink alcohol. The results were disastrous. The results were catastrophic. Alcoholism became a bigger problem during the prohibition than it had been before. People who would otherwise not have consumed alcohol now did it because it was prohibited. That's where human nature comes in. You see, in Italy, we have the lowest numbers of alcoholics. There's a reason for that. For Italian kids, alcohol is something natural. It is served in moderation at every main meal. Kids grow up with alcohol, not looking at it as something strange, prohibited, which we have to get into if we can. You see, here in the United States, alcohol is prohibited for kids in public, even in the company of their parents, up until a certain age. Now that, brethren, is a wrong approach. Understand, it's a law, but it's a wrong approach. The Bible allows, and in certain cases encourages, the modern use of alcohol. During Passover, of course, the use of alcohol is commanded. We all understand that. But now notice 1 Timothy chapter 5, and let's look at a few examples of moderate use of alcohol as it is recommended in the Bible. In this particular case, we find a statement by Paul to Timothy. And he says in 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 23, no longer drink only water, but use a little wine for your stomach's sake and your frequent infirmities or illnesses. So here was Timothy, who apparently was sick quite frequently, and Paul recommended that he drink some water. I'm sorry, that he drink some wine and not only water, because it is understood that wine does have some healing effects. Now, at the same time, the Bible prohibits, of course, excessive drinking of alcohol, and Paul says the same thing in the same letter just a few chapters back in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 8. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 8, and he's talking about qualifications of deacons, but this applies to all of us. 1 Timothy 3 and verse 8 says, likewise deacons must be reverent, not double-tongued, not given too much wine. Not given too much wine, it says. So again, the warning is there. The warning is also there in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 18. Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 18. Paul is telling all of us, do not be drunk with wine, in which is dissipation. So, in other words, he says, don't get drunk. Don't get to the point where you don't know anymore what you are doing. Like, you know, Glenn Campbell doesn't have any recollection anymore the next day what happened the previous day. I have known people where that was the case. Now, they weren't alcoholics necessarily, but they would drink too much, and then in particular cases it would become aggressive. I mean, it depends what kind of a nature you got. And then the next day they wouldn't remember. They just wouldn't remember what all they did say and what all they did do. Galatians chapter 5. Galatians chapter 5, beginning verse 19. Now, this is a strong warning, of course. Paul is talking about the works of the flesh, and they are evident. And then he lists some of them, like adultery, fornication. We'll talk about that in a moment. But then he goes on to say in verse 21, envy, murders, drunkenness, and the like, of which I tell you beforehand, just as I also told you in times past, that those who practice such things will not inherit the kingdom of God. So this is not a light matter in the eyes of Paul, in the eyes of God. It's something to take to heart. Don't become an alcoholic. Don't become used to the practice of drinking too much. You see, the Bible describes the effects of someone who is addicted to alcohol in the book of Proverbs. Let's go back to Proverbs chapter 23. And notice verse 20. Proverbs chapter 23, beginning in verse 20. It says, you do not mix with wine bibbers or with gluttonous eaters of meat. Verse 21, for the drunkards and the glutton will come to poverty, and drowsiness will clothe a man with rags. But then he goes on to describe in a person who is addicted to alcohol, beginning at verse 29, who has woe, who has sorrow, who has contentions, who has complaints, who has wounds without cause, who has redness of eyes. Those who linger long at the wine, those who go in search of mixed wine, do not look on the wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it swirls around smoothly. At the last it bites like a serpent and stings like a viper. Your eyes will see strange things, and your heart will utter perverse things. See, and then later you won't even remember all the things you might have done or you might have said. Verse 34, and you will be like one who lies down in the midst of the sea, or like one who lies at the top of the mast, saying, they have struck me, but I wasn't hurt. They have beaten me, but I didn't feel it. When shall I awake that I may seek another drink? A person who is addicted to it, who can't wait to continue having some alcoholic beverages. You see, alcoholic addiction, brethren, is a serious matter. But you know, it doesn't start there. It starts with just a few drinks too many. I did some extensive research in so far as the sermon was concerned, and so I found an interesting article on the web, which I'd like to read a little bit from. What causes drug addiction and alcoholism? The article says, no one wants to be a drug addict or an alcoholic, but this doesn't stop people from getting addicted. The most commonly asked question is simply how. How could my son, my daughter, father, sister, brother become a liar, a thief, someone who cannot be trusted? How could this happen? And why won't they stop? The first thing you must understand about addiction is that alcohol and addictive drugs are basically pain killers. They chemically kill physical or emotional pain and alter the mind's perception of reality. They make people numb. For drugs to be attractive to a person, there must first be some underlying unhappiness, sense of hopelessness, of physical pain. So obviously, that's my comment right now, to stop this terrible procedure from going on, we have to have hopefulness, we have to have happiness, and we won't get to the point where we then start to drink too much. And it goes on to say, in medical terms, a drug is any substance that, when taken into a living organism, may modify one or more of its functions. Drugs can provide temporary relief from unhealthy symptoms and or permanently supply the body with the necessary substance the body can no longer make. Some drugs produce unwanted side effects. In large enough doses, all drugs are toxic. Some drugs lead to an unhealthy dependency that has both psychological and behavioral roots. And then it says, alcoholism is a major social, economic, and public health problem. Alcohol is involved in more than half of all accidental deaths and almost half of all traffic fatalities. A high percentage of suicides involves the use of alcohol in combination with other substances. Additional deaths are related to the long-term medical complications associated with the disease. But now notice, only 15%, 1/5, of those with alcohol dependency seek treatment for this disease. It is a serious matter, and of course, it is something which we shouldn't get into. To avoid it is not to start drinking too much to begin with. But that brings me to the second topic I'd like to talk about. It's already related to what I've said, smoking. Now, when it comes to alcohol, brethren, we have seen from the Bible that we can have and should have a balanced approach toward this. The Bible doesn't prohibit it, but the Bible does prohibit the excessive drinking. When it comes to smoking, there's no balanced reason whatsoever ever to smoke. The Bible clearly prohibits it. It doesn't allow smoking. Smoking is wrong for the smoker and the society. I was shocked, and maybe I shouldn't have been, but I was in Germany now, again, to see 14, 13, 12-year-old kids publicly, openly smoke on the streets. Every relative I had over there in Germany, from my wife's relative viewpoint, except my parents-in-law, they all smoke, pretty much. I think maybe the one doesn't do anymore. It becomes common. See, the mother smokes, the father smokes, and of course then the kids pick it up and they smoke. Let me read to you some interesting comments, again, something which I found on the webpage. Smoking is a serious health issue, one that has become a national health concern. Smoking-related diseases claim an estimated 440,000 American lives each year, including those affected indirectly, such as babies born prematurely. In fact, 1 in 5 deaths in the United States is smoking-related. Smoking is proven addictive. Nicotine is addictive and quitting is very difficult. And now listen to this. Most people are addicted to tobacco before the age of 20. Addicted before the age of 20. Most adolescents start smoking for social reasons with the belief that they can quit it. But 44% of those who believed that in 5 years they would not be smoking, 77% remained daily smokers. Why would they start it? Because of social norms, because of advertising, because of social pressure, because everybody else does it, the peer group does it, so I have to do it, and because of curiosity. Now, what was, in a sense, frightening to me is how long it takes if somebody is a smoker and then he stops smoking, how long it takes to get back to a quote-unquote healthy condition. Now, some beneficial health changes appear quite quickly. For instance, 20 minutes after you stop smoking, the blood pressure and the pulse rate return to normal. After 72 hours, breathing becomes easier. But it takes 1 year. 1 year that your risk of heart attack falls to about half that of a smoker. It takes 10 years that the risk of lung cancer falls to half that of a smoker. It takes 15 years that the risk of heart attack falls to the same as someone who has never smoked in his life. You see, when my dad was 50, the doctor called him in, and he said to him, if you don't stop smoking, you will die soon. You see, all his brothers were dying at the time. They were all dying of lung cancer. They were all heavy smokers. My dad was a heavy smoker, too. He smoked everything there was, pipe, cigarettes, cigars. And he decided, if I don't stop smoking, I'll be dead in the next 5 years. And so he, from one minute to the next, stopped smoking. Now, of course, he got sick because he was extremely addicted to smoking, so he had to take all kinds of pills to take care of the nicotine addiction. But he has never, ever smoked since that time when he was 50. Now, he recently died. He was 95. But you see, the lesson is, if you are a smoker, quit immediately. If you are not a smoker, never, ever become one. Never, ever become one. And so since a Christian must not smoke, that's a sin. Anyway, it goes without saying that he or she mustn't use illicit drugs. But at the same time, let me also mention that a Christian must also be careful when he uses legitimate drugs. Let me first of all read to you from our booklet, Sickness and Health. And I'd like to read from page 35. A brief portion. And we say in here, addictive vices such as smoking, excessive consumption of alcohol, or the use of illicit or recreational drugs such as marijuana or hashish are sure to bring on sickness. If a person who smokes develops cancer, that person cannot expect God to heal him or her if he or she is determined to continue smoking. The same can be said about one who consumes an excessive amount of alcohol and who hasn't been diagnosed or has been diagnosed with liver or kidney problems. Why should we expect God to honor our request for physical healing if we continue to abuse our bodies? But then we also point out on page 33 something which people couldn't believe. They actually called us or wrote us and said, oh, you must have made a mistake here. You meant something different. No, I said we meant exactly what we wrote. Let me quote it to you on page 33. Although it's not inherently wrong to take medications, nor does it show a lack of faith, we must be very careful in the choice of the medications. A recent study published in the Kalifornische Staatszeitung, that's a German paper which is published here in the United States, but in German, reveals that one-third of all medications offered in Germany do not help at all, and in many cases the medications produce harmful side effects. The Journal of the American Medical Association pointed out in July of 2000 that doctors are the third leading cause of death in the United States, causing 250,000 deaths every year from correctly prescribed drugs. So people said, oh, you must have made a mistake. You must have meant from incorrectly prescribed drugs. No. From correctly prescribed drugs, based on their understanding of science, these drugs were correctly prescribed. And as a consequence, 250,000 people died. I'd like to read to you from the Internet some statistics. The leading cause of death in 2000 were tobacco. 435,000 deaths. That is 2000. Now, it didn't get any better subsequently. Other causes of death were incidents involving firearms, in spite of those who proposed that everybody should have a free access to guns. Well, 29,000 people died because of that free access to guns in 2000, probably more now. And illicit use of drugs, 17,000. According to Canadian researchers, approximately 32,000 hospitalized patients and possibly as many as 106,000 in the U.S. die each year because of adverse reactions to their prescribed medications. Now, that was from 2000. Again, it probably went higher. It says illicit drug use is associated with suicide, homicide, motor vehicle injury, HIV infection, pneumonia, violence, mental illness, hepatitis. An estimated 3 million individuals in the United States have serious drug problems. Why? Peer pressure. The social environment have a lot to do with it. You see, when young people, or older people for that matter, begin to smoke, begin to take drugs, begin to drink excessively, it's in many cases peer pressure. Everybody does it. We want to do it. You know, the Bible does warn, and this is why we are talking about balanced Christian living. We're not supposed to leave the world. At the same time, the Bible warns against having too much contact with the wrong kind of people. And it tells us to be strong enough to stand up for what's right, even in the face of the wrong people, if you are getting in contact with them. Notice with me Proverbs chapter 1. Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 10. Here's a father talking to his son. And he's saying, my son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. Now, these are just a few words. They have a tremendous amount of meaning and of wisdom. First of all, here is a father teaching his son, showing that we parents are supposed to teach our children. And then it says, if sinners entice you, hey, let's have a joint. Let's drink that additional drink. Let's have a smoke. Do not consent. It's easy. Well, it's not that easy, right? But that's what we are supposed to be doing. That's easy sense. Go to chapter 2 and verse 10. See, it really boils down to what's most important in our lives. Is it to be accepted by our peers, or is it to be accepted by God? Proverbs chapter 2 and verse 10. It says, when wisdom enters your heart and knowledge is pleasant to your soul, discretion will preserve you. Understanding will keep you to deliver you from the way of evil, from the man who speaks perverse things, from those who leave the path of uprightness to walk in the ways of darkness, who rejoice in doing evil. See, they may not know it. They rejoice in taking drugs. They rejoice in drinking too much. They rejoice in smoking. They don't realize perhaps even that it's evil. But God says, don't go along with that. They delight in the perversity of the wicked, whose ways are crooked and who are devious in their paths. And so he goes on to say in chapter 4, beginning in verse 10, Proverbs 4 and verse 10, hear, my son, and receive my sayings, and the years of your life will be many. You know, smoking is a good example. You start smoking, the years of your life won't be many. I have taught you in the way of wisdom. I have led you in right path. When you walk, your steps will not be hindered. When you run, you will not stumble. Take firm hold of instruction. Do not let go. Keep her, for she is your life. Do not enter the path of the wicked. Do not walk in the way of evil. Avoid it. Do not travel on it. Turn away from it and pass on. For they do not sleep unless they have done evil, and their sleep is taken away unless they make someone fall. You know, let's go with us. Let's go to that place we shouldn't go to and having fun there. And they eat the bread of wickedness and drink the wine of violence. It is important. We can't overemphasize it. It is important who are our close friends with whom we spend a lot of time. Notice Proverbs chapter 12. Again, we're not to leave the world, to leave everybody behind. Christ told us to go into the world. But nevertheless, it is important with whom we are spending a lot of our time. Proverbs 12 and verse 26. The righteous should choose his friends carefully, for the way of the wicked leads them astray. Well, many don't believe that. Many feel, oh, well, we are strong enough to withstand them. No, that's not what the Bible says. The way of the wicked will lead them astray. That brings me to issue number 3. You may be waiting for the humor, it's still coming. But not necessarily now. Premarital sex. Wow. Balanced approach towards premarital sex. The Bible is clear. Unmarried people should not, must not engage in sexual conduct. Now, the Bible calls premarital sex fornication. Anytime you read, specifically in the New Testament, you read the word fornication, what's being talking about here is premarital sex. You see, premarital sex or fornication is sexual conduct between two unmarried people. If one of the two is married, you're talking about adultery. What is fornication? Well, going to the dictionaries, it's Funk and Wagnall, standard desk dictionary, that's got to be correct. That's what it says. Fornication is a voluntary sexual intercourse between unmarried persons. The American Heritage Dictionary goes a little bit further, gives first the same identical definition, but then it explains where the word comes from. The word fornication comes from the Latin word fornicate, and that in turn is derived from the Latin word fornix. And that was a vaulted underground dwelling in Rome where prostitutes lived. So the word fornication is derived from the word prostitute. If we go to Matthew chapter 15, beginning in verse 18, we find that Christ very clearly explains that fornication is not only wrong, but it is the result of evil thoughts in the heart of a person. Matthew 15, beginning in verse 18, it says, "For those things which proceed out of the mouth come from the heart, and they defile a man, they defile a person. For out of the heart proceeds evil thoughts," and then he goes on, "murders, adulteries, fornications." See, adulteries, again, is sexual intercourse between a married and an unmarried person. Could be intercourse between two married persons, but then they're not married towards each other. Fornication is sexual intercourse between unmarried people. Christ says that's not something we should get engaged in. Paul says the same in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, beginning in verse 13. So again, looking at it from a balanced Christian living standpoint, there is really no balance in doing it. 1 Corinthians 6, beginning in verse 13, he says, and I'm just quoting the highlights here, "The body is not for sexual immorality," it says here in the New King James, the word is fornication. The body is not for fornication, but it is for the Lord. Verse 15, "Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make the members of a harlot?" See, making the connection here between fornication and prostitution. Certainly not. Remember, the word fornication is derived from the sexual intercourse with harlots in Rome. He goes on to say in verse 18, "Flee sexual immorality," or "flee fornication. Every sin that a man or a person does is outside the body, but he who commits sexual immorality or fornication sins against his own body." I mean, the comments couldn't be any clearer. Fornication is a grievous sin. In Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 3, Paul is saying, "Fornication and all uncleanness, let it not even be named among you, as is fitting for saints." Verse 5, "For this we know, that no fornicator," etc., "has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God." So you like with those who are, you know, addicted to alcohol, and unless they get rid of that, they're not going to inherit the kingdom of God. But the same is true here for fornicators, and of course a lot of other people who are being mentioned here, but I'm just focusing on that right now. And then he goes on to say, and here is the crux of the matter, "Let no one deceive you with empty words." Today in our society, this is the thing to do. You know, you live with somebody together for a while to find out whether that person is compatible to you before you get married. No, Paul says, "Let no one deceive you with empty words. For because of these things, the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Therefore, do not be partakers with them." No, you be different. You don't get involved in this kind of thing. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verse 3, Again, it couldn't be any clearer, for this is the will of God, your sanctification, that you should abstain from, it says here, sexual immorality. The word again is fornication. Now, realistically, I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, obviously, and I'm asking not you on the internet to send me a letter, but realistically, perhaps you might have engaged in some kind of conduct in this regard you shouldn't have. God forgives. You know, in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, beginning at verse 9, he talks about again that neither fornicators, nor adulterers, nor homosexuals, nor sodomites, nor thieves will inherit the kingdom of God. Then he goes on to say, and such were some of you in the church. You know, this talks about those who had committed fornication, adultery, homosexuality, sodomites. Paul says, such were some of you. But you were washed, he goes on to say. You were sanctified. You were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus and by the Spirit of your God. That's washed away. It's forgiven. Based on repentance. Based on, of course, a different way of life. Repentance, of course, must be honest, must be true. It must be proven to God by our conduct, by our actions. Because, you see, just knowing that what we do is sinful, maybe feeling sorry about it, but continuing in doing it is not enough. Proverbs chapter 28 and verse 13 tells us, and just reading it to you, he who covers his sins will not prosper, but whoever confesses and forsakes them will have mercy. But now the question arises, how are we to prevent in our society the sin of fornication? And if we are parents, how are we to raise our children and teens to prevent them to commit that sin, to commit that sin? What should our balanced approach be in this regard? You know, I remember when I was attending Ambassador College, a friend of mine, he was the student body president. He was a little bit older like I was. Of course, I was already married, so it didn't affect me that much. I still had to go to the principles of living class, where people were told how to date so that they could get married to a proper person. I raised my hand and I said, does it apply to me? The guy looks at me and says, no, I think you're already married. So I said, what am I doing here? But anyway, the student body president, he was older as well, and he was seen, observed, walking hand in hand on campus with a girl who he was to marry right after his graduation. I think they did marry. So he was called in. They said to him, you know, they're giving a bad example because you're walking hand in hand. What do you think people will say when they see you doing that? And he said, well, they will say we're walking hand in hand. No, they said, that's not what you're supposed to be answering. So I have to call your dad. So they called the father. Father said, you know, how old is my son? Oh, he's 23, 24. He said, okay, he should know how to act. And that was the end of that one. Nevertheless, the wrong decision was made at the time to take away his position as student body president. Let me read to you an interesting article I found on the webpage. It's an excellent article. Couldn't believe, because I could have said it the same way, but I want to read it to you because somebody else said it for me. Premarital sex and parenting. Let me read it to you. Many parents feel absolutely distressed and confused when confronted with the issue of their children at premarital sex. And well, they might. Children can see all around them conflicting messages from television and movies, from books, from their peers, from their boyfriends, their girlfriends, the people whom they may think care for them most. Unfortunately, many parents find themselves so lost that they react by trying to blank out these messages altogether. They don't allow their children to go to movies. They censor what books they read. They forbid them from dating. This poses many problems. First of all, seeing movies and dating are a normal part of being a teenager. Premarital sex doesn't have to be a product of this. Censoring the books that your children read is also not an effective way to deal with this. If your teenager reads, you are indeed lucky. I would agree with that. It goes on to say, the bottom line in all of this is that you cannot block messages that say premarital sex is okay from your kids, because they are all around you, those messages. If you try to do that, they will only become so curious that they will probably become sneaky. You also might infuriate your child so much by forbidding him or her to date a certain person or not at all, that you run the severe danger of raising a teen who is rebellious only for the sake of being rebellious. And if he or she sees that what you want is premarital abstinence, you take the serious gamble of shooting yourself in the foot. Well, you say, I shouldn't try to block messages condoning premarital sex. What should I do? The answer is simple. Instead of trying to keep your teen a child, by blocking negative messages, teach your teen to ignore the messages. This will take some stress off of yourself. You won't have to wonder if your teen is being sneaky. And this will make your teen feel that you trust him or her, and he or she will, in turn, trust you and your judgment about things like sex. The best thing for a parent to do is not to make the decision that your teen will not have premarital sex, but instead to help your teen build a strong foundation of faith so that when the occasion comes, he or she will say, I am going strong enough to wait. Not, well, my parents wouldn't find out. The difference between good and bad parenting is this. The bad parent makes the child's decision for him, and thus makes him morally dependent on his parent or unreasonably rebellious. The good parent teaches and allows the child to make the right decision and thus empowers him. Now, how can you empower your teen to make the right decision? The answer to this question is not so simple, but the best way is to be an example. Let you and your spouse be a loving example that abstaining from premarital sex doesn't lead to a disputatious, boring married life. Don't fight in front of your children. Show them that there is hardly any other joy that compares with that of loving one person with all of your heart and with all for all of your life. You also must not take your marriage for granted. If you were a teen and were told that marriage is something to be endured, something boring, something restricting, and not something cherished and beautiful, what reason would you have to believe that you should try to harness your desires and wait for it? If teens don't see through you and your spouse that real, true, lasting love exists, they are more likely to think that since they will never find real love, why wait? Show them that you are happy with married life. Be an example of trust, love, happiness, and faith to your child, and he or she will follow your leads. This is truly the high road of parenting, but being an example is the only road for any parent who is really concerned about the welfare of the child. How can one help the child to make the right decision about sex? You can give support in areas of life that have nothing to do with sex. Suggest, without being demanding, that your teen read and reread the Bible. Let your teen come to see that real depth and universality of the Bible. Don't preach. Show your teen that he or she should go right to the source. You should also encourage your teen to read other books so that he or she will become the kind of critical thinker who can ignore propaganda and negative messages about sex. Encourage your teen to partake of school and church activities. Let your teen see that Christianity is not, as Homer Simpson once put it, a bunch of well-meaning rules that don't work out in real life. That's the easy way out. If we tell ourselves that it's just not possible to be real Christians, we won't be. Show your teen that a Christian life is not only fulfilling, but it's entirely possible. In this tumultuous time in your teen's life, remember that you and your teen will both make mistakes, but you can avoid some of them by keeping your cool and keeping the faith. You must start from the inside out so that your child can rely on the strong core of faith that comes from strong parenting. If you do this, you can rest assured that even when your teen moves out of the house, he or she will look back to the years with you for guidance, instead of thinking that he or she has finally been let loose. There's a lot of wisdom and truth in that approach. Teach by example. Don't overregulate, because if you do, as a parent, you might have the opposite result, which you don't want. And that gets me to the next point I'd like to talk about, marriage and divorce. You know, when I did the research on the internet regarding marriage and divorce and looking for causes for divorce, I found the following humorous and perhaps not so humorous suggestions for the cause of divorce. Here we go. Daughters. Now, why would a daughter be the cause of divorce? Well, simply because when they got married, the husband wanted a son. So the daughter came, divorce. Viagra. Now, do I have to explain that one? Mobile phone messages. Now, I don't know what the mobile phone messages would have entailed, but they were given as one source and cause for divorce. Real estate. Now, that strikes home more, because that's talking about people buying a home, getting in all kinds of problems with it, getting in all kinds of debts, and then unable to handle that situation. Internet, but in the sense of online dating. In other words, people get to know each other over the internet and then marry. Problem, because they have never found out that they're really compatible. Delinquency of children, because children do bad things and the parents can quite agree with how to handle it, and then of course they get into a fight. And finally, adultery and whoredom. Now that, of course, makes a lot of sense. But finally, the question was asked, why do people divorce? Answer, because they can. Now that is an interesting concept, because that's very true. In our society today, divorce is looked at the easy way out. This is not balanced Christian living at all. In fact, divorce is in most cases the easy way in. That is, into disaster, into economic hardship, into bankruptcy. Now, we all understand there are exceptions for divorce where it's legitimate. We understand that you are married to an unconverted maid, the unconverted maid departs from the marriage relationship, departs from you. He doesn't have to file for divorce. He still could stick around to get a free ride, but you know, if that is his attitude, then the other maid is free to divorce. But to go back to a teaching we once had, which was wrong, where we say even if you are not called yet, and you happen to be married, and then you get a divorce, and then you get called, you always understood that God accepts you at the moment, in the state in which you are in, when you are called, specifically when you are baptized. For some, as recently has happened in one particular case, to forsake that marriage of 20-plus years with grown children, because that person had been divorced before the person became converted, that's not only unbalanced, that's a horrible, terrible misapplication of Scripture. But brethren, the cause for divorce is in most cases the incompatibility, you're not incompatible. I mean, you're incompatible, whatever the word is, incompatibility. Boy, what a tongue twister. The incompatibility of the partners to begin with. See, they should have never gotten married to begin with in the first place. And that is why we do read in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 the admonition of Paul, which is still very much valid today. 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 39. We read, a wife is bound by law as long as her husband lives. But if her husband dies, she is at liberty to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. That means only when both parties are converted Christians. Now, if already a relationship exists, a marriage relationship between a converted and unconverted person, then the unconverted mate has become sanctified through that relationship. That is, he or she has now access to God if he or she wants to. But there is no guarantee. There's no guarantee that that person responds to that opportunity. And that is why God says, don't enter into such a relationship if you want to have a successful, compatible marriage. But if you are in it, he says, don't you divorce unless the unconverted mate forsakes you and the marriage obligations. It's got to be the unconverted mate's doing it the other way around, you see. That's why this example I gave earlier is such an absolutely horrible transgression of the law of God. To forsake a marriage where the husband is willing to live with a wife who is supposedly converted. Now, you must be old enough to understand, of course, that you enter into a commitment for life. You must be in a position, education-wise, job-wise, money-wise, to enter into such a marriage relationship. And that's why we read something very profound in the book of Proverbs, chapter 24. See, that all is part of balanced Christian living. You don't rush into a situation you can't control, you can't handle. So the Bible tells us in Proverbs chapter 24 and verse 27 that we are to prepare our outside work first. Our outside work, that means our job. We have a steady income, we have an education, that all is taken care of. Make it fit for yourself in the fields. All that's being done. And then he goes on to say, and afterwards, build your house. Then you can create your own household. Then you can create your own family after the elements, the necessary elements, are already in existence. And another important thing is necessary. Go back to Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24. In Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24, because when you marry, you are to leave your parents and you are to create your own house or your own households. Genesis 2 and verse 24. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother, and the same is true for the wife, and be joined to his wife, and the wife is to be joined to the husband, and they shall become one flesh. Now, let me just say that that is extremely important, and I'm speaking from experience. When my wife and I got married, we did have our own household for a year, and then we made the fundamental mistake of moving back to our parents. Now, we were living upstairs, they were living downstairs, but it was a disaster. I'm going to read an article to you in a few minutes, and it will explain a little bit why it was a disaster. The Bible says don't do that. Don't do that. You create your own household. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't take care of your parents if they need to be taken care of. I'm talking about the general situation where that isn't the case. And finally, brethren, if you want to get married, I can't overemphasize that enough either, counsel with a true minister of God. The emphasis is true. Now, you've got to decide where you find one. But counsel with a true minister of God, not one who has had 5 or 6 or 7 divorces himself, before you get married. You may also read an interesting booklet, if you haven't already done so. It's called The Keys to Happy Marriages and Families. Now, that was written for married couples. It was written for those who want to get married. It was written for teenagers. It was written for parents. So I recommend you read that as well. You see, brethren, divorces don't come from nowhere. Many times they occur because the marriage partners were not prepared enough for the lifetime adventure. And it is an adventure of marriage. And here comes into play again balanced Christian living of both parents and young adults. So now let me read to you this article I already alluded to. It's called Causes of Divorce. While living in St. Louis, Several years ago, I read an article in the local newspaper which stated that the divorce rate in the United States was leveling off at the rate of about one in every two marriages ending in divorce. With this kind of leveling off, we do not have much to be excited about. See, one out of two. Probably today it's even more. This article is about a couple years old. Goes on to say, for many years, the number of divorces in this nation has increased. In 1975, for the very first time in history, there were over 1 million divorces in this nation. That number has increased since then. What is the cause or the causes for this alarming number of divorces? I do not claim to have all the answers, but I do believe that I have observed certain things that contribute to the many divorces that take place each year. The very fact that so many are getting divorces is one factor that encourages so many divorces. Remember, I asked earlier the question, why do many people divorce? Because they can. It goes on to say here, in years past, divorce was frowned upon by nearly everyone in our society. Getting a divorce was an admission of failure and was a shameful thing. I'm sorry to say that this is no longer the case. The attitude of everyone is doing it seems to prevail. Getting a divorce is now the in thing and nothing for which one needs to be ashamed. That shouldn't be the case. Another problem is a failure of parents to properly teach their children. Paul instructs fathers to bring up their children in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord, Ephesians 6 and verse 4. One hasn't done this if he fails to teach the children the Lord's will pertaining to the marriage relationship. God's will is very plain. When a man and a woman are married, they have made a lifelong commitment to one another, Romans 7, verses 2 and 3. Parents, we need to teach our children from the time they are able to be taught. When they reach the age when they will be selecting a marriage companion, they must consider this a relationship which will exist so long as they both shall live. To fail in teaching this truth is to fail in providing proper teaching for our children. This failure in teaching is a contributing factor in another cause for divorce. Many young people enter into marriage with the attitude of mind that if things don't work out as they would desire, they can always get a divorce. One of my relatives got a divorce. She has a lovely daughter, but the parents are divorced. Terrible situation. Young people, and old ones as well, the article goes on to say, need to understand that when difficulties and problems arise, and they surely will, divorce is not an option they have, and they must never be considered as a solution to their problems. Now, I almost hate to read the next paragraph, but for, you know, completeness sakes, I will. Selfishness is another cause of divorce. Paul instructs husbands to love their wives as their own bodies. No problem with that. But you will see in a moment what I mean, because he quotes here Ephesians 5 and verse 28. A failure to show love will lead to problems and heartaches. I have known men, see, that's why it's problematic. If she would have said, I have known women, it would be different. But I have known men, I'm just kidding, who thought of no one but themselves. They would spend all their free, quote-unquote, time doing only the thing they enjoyed doing. They would spend large sums of money on themselves and on things they wanted, but would never consider doing the same for their wives. Now, that's very true. That is very true. It goes on to say, as long as husbands and wives continue or think to think only for themselves and of themselves and their own selfish desires, we will continue to see these marriages ending in divorce. Several years ago, I had the opportunity to talk to a judge that had presided over many divorce cases. I asked him what he thought was the number one cause of divorce. I was somewhat surprised of his answer. He told me that the number one cause of divorce, in his opinion, was the interference of in-laws. The interference of in-laws. He noted that even when other problems were given as a cause of divorce, investigation would show that these problems had often come about as a result of either his or her parents interfering in the marriage. Whether you agree with the judge about this being the number one cause or not, you must admit that this is a problem in many marriages. God said that a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave unto his wife, Genesis 2:24. This applies to the woman as well. So many young people are not willing, or I might add, they are not able to leave father and mother, but they fail to realize that their first responsibility, as far as human relationships are concerned, is now to their husbands and their wife. They need to let their mate know this in word and in action. To fail this is to invite disaster. However, not all of the problem lies with young people unwilling to leave father and mother. Many parents are unwilling to let them leave. Many fathers just cannot accept the fact that someone else now has a responsibility of providing for his little girl. If you've never seen the movie Father of the Bride, I recommend you watch that one. It gives an interesting summary of that concept. But the article goes on to say, and many mothers feel that they must tell their daughter-in-law how her quote-unquote little boy must be cared for. My wife's smiling. She knows what I'm talking about, because that's exactly what happens. Exactly what happens. Parents, he goes on to say, we need to teach our children to obey God's will, and this means that we need to teach them to leave father and mother and to cleave to their husband or wife. I've seen parents interfere in their children's marriages, and then when divorce finally comes, they're ready to say, see, I told you that he or she wasn't good for you. What they never admit is that if they had not interfered, their son or daughter could have had a very happy and long-lasting marriage. Of course, in all of these causes, we see a failure to respect God and His will. This we must do if the divorce problem is to be eliminated. Again, I thought, very good advice. Let's see, how much time do I still have? Remember, the test is still coming. So let's go to the last point I want to address today. And this is going to be bound to be causing all kinds of reactions. Television. Movies, music, internet. What should our balanced approach toward these things be? I have heard so many unbalanced, extreme concepts about it. I have hardly the time to list them all. I just want to give you a few. Somebody said to me, Elvis Presley can't sing. That's kind of humorous. But, you know, I said, well, I like Elvis Presley. Oh, he can't sing. So I had him at my place, and then I played to him a record of religious songs. He was surprised how good he sang. The Beatles, terrible music. The Hollies, if you are old enough to remember them, terrible music, people say. Well, Placido Domingo, opera singers like Peter Hoffmann, they used the music and they created the most beautiful records. Now, Elvis Presley did some bad stuff. The Beatles did some bad stuff. I don't like all the music the Hollies did either, although I like most. The point is, many people generalize rather than getting involved and finding out exactly what the truth is. I heard when I was at Ambassador College, somebody came up with the idea, rock and roll is bad, and the reason it's bad is because the rhythm of rock and roll is against the heartbeat's rhythm. But then a minister who was also a musician came to me and said, well, with that rationale, you shouldn't listen to Vienna waltzes either, because that rhythm is also against the heartbeat rhythm. Some people have said, oh, you know, the reason Beatles music is bad because you only have to play it backwards and you get all kinds of demonic messages. Well, people have done that with religious songs and they have come up with the same kind of conclusion. Some people have had such a tremendous extreme viewpoints that it became unreal. I remember my little girl over there, who has helped us this morning, by the way, with the music, you know, the accompanying music. So it did a good job. She sang. I'm sorry, she didn't sing. Well, she sang too, but that's not what I'm talking about. She danced. She was, I think it was kindergarten age, and she sang. And she danced with some other kids in the auditorium. They had these dance recitals. It was beautiful. Cute. They were dancing to a song by the Beach Boys. I think it was California Surfing or something like that. And so they were all dressed up, you know, it was nice beach, clothes. It was beautiful. But the daughter of the guy who was in charge at the time went to the father and said, oh, you shouldn't allow the Beach Boys to perform at the auditorium. But the Beach Boys didn't perform. See, they just played a song. And so the debts, a minister who is not with us, quickly, I want to admit that and say that very quickly, that you don't get any wrong ideas. So he's not with us. There are reasons for that. He got the people in who were responsible for that dance recital and shoot them out. How inappropriate that were. When I heard that, I thought, boy, how unbalanced can one be? You know, the last feast, Michael sang a song. I asked my daughter this morning again what the group was. And I again forgot. Was it Lame Duck or Cold Duck or something like that? They were laughing. So I never heard of the group, frankly. Cold Heart it was, right? Coldplay. Okay, well, it was close, wasn't it? But a nice song. Now, I'd never listened to the group because it was, quote-unquote, a modern group, so I wasn't listening to it. And I admit, well, you know, maybe I don't know all about what I should be knowing. And so that was a nice song. See, people say, oh, you can't listen to this kind of music because look what the Beatles stood for. Look what Elvis Presley stood for and what he did do. Well, with that same rationale, you can, for instance, listen to music by Mozart. And you look at how he lived his life. Or you can, for instance, listen to music by Franz Lehár. Now, you may not even know who Franz Lehár is, but he was a very well-known composer. For instance, he composed songs like Dein ist mein ganzes Herz. You know that song? You probably heard it. Everybody sings it. He was the one who composed it. But he also collaborated with the Nazis in World War II. You see? Where do you draw the line? Now, you look at music for what it's like. Don't look at all the other elements which may have nothing to do with a piece of music. You still listen, for instance, to the Young Ambassadors, at least I do. Well, songs written by Ross Judson. But, you know, if you look at what Ross Judson is doing these days, quite different, right, from what he did when he sang and composed those songs. Now, what about TV causing violence? Now, that's an age-old question. Some have concluded, yes, TV causes violence, and they have blamed, you know, this on TV, and they have banned a TV set from their home, so they have no TV at home. Now, I've known of a minister who did that, but unfortunately, that minister became later on divorced from his own wife, and it is his own kind of things, and what I'm saying is, and this is perhaps my own personal opinion, but it's based on experience, it's based on long, many years of experience, this is a solution which is potentially dangerous, with potentially dangerous repercussions. Remember the prohibition of alcohol. You see, it didn't help, it hurt. Unless we can clearly prove from the Bible that TV per se is bad, like smoking is bad, drugs, illicit drugs are bad. They should be banned. But if you can't prove that from the Bible, that everything TV stands for is bad, we shouldn't take those drastic measures. You know, I had these arguments before with people who strongly advocated we have to get rid of TV. And I said, well, what do you do with Mr. Armstrong's TV programs? I said, you never have a chance to listen to them because you don't have TV. Think about it. See, where would the Worldwide Church of God under Mr. Armstrong had been at the time without television? You know, Mr. Armstrong expected the members to support that. He most certainly expected them to watch those programs themselves. Internet's the same thing. Internet is good and it's bad, but we have internet websites. Where would we be today without that? We have standing watch programs which we put on the website, and the members should be listening to those too. In order to do that, you have to have a computer. Now, let me read to you an exhibit, first of all, which takes a very strong viewpoint, but there are some elements of truth in that. The question is, does television cause violence? An anti-TV mom on a homeschooling discussion list, which shall not be named, wrote, "The problems may very, very well go away if TV goes away. Violence, Columbine, where do kids get the ideas to kill other kids? TV." Answer. Great Britain passed the Juvenile Offensive Act of 1847, which said young people should not go to the same prison as adults. They did it because of public concern over the huge numbers of young kids going to jail, not just on murder charges, with adult criminals. Some figures show the crime rate in England jumped from 5,000 crimes a year to 20,000 times a year in the 1830s. No one can ban TV for that one. Wasn't around. Next one. 14-year-old Jesse Pomeroy was arrested in 1874 for the murder of a 4-year-old. He was released and immediately killed a 10-year-old girl and then another 4-year-old. No TV around. In 1924, 19-year-olds Richard Loeb and Nathan Leopold murdered Bobby Franks just to see what it was like. They were from well-off families and nice neighborhoods. Never saw TV. As a matter of fact, when I was in school, when I grew up, that happened to me one time where a gang of schoolmates, I believe I was 8 or 9, they came to me, they grabbed me, they threw me on the street, and when they were called in by the teachers and asked why they did it, they said, oh, they wanted to see how a young person dies. Well, at that time, there wasn't even any TV around in Germany. That came much later. It goes on to say in this article, in Bass, Michigan, in May 1927, Andrew Kehoe was 50. He committed the worst case of school violence in American history, worse than Columbine. First, he killed his wife. He locked his animals in the barn and blew them up. He blew up the school where he was a handyman and blew up his truck full of shrapnel. More explosives were set to go off to kill rescue workers, but were found by the police. In all, 38 children were killed and 7 teachers. 60-some others were injured. Mr. Cologne never saw the TV set. So it's clear then, brethren, that TV doesn't cause television. I mean, that is absolutely clear. But that's not even the question. The question is, do they contribute? Do television and movies contribute to violence? Now, that question is much more differentiated. Let me read to you this article, which I found on the web. It's titled, Violence in TV and Film. The question is, does the violence on TV and film contribute to violence in society? This question has been debated for many years. During that time, some 2,500 books and articles have been written on the effects of TV and film violence on human behavior. Studies done in both the United States and Canada have shown a positive relationship between early exposure to TV violence and physical aggressiveness in later life. Even so, a clear cause-effect relationship is complicated by the fact that children are typically exposed to many stimuli as they grow up, many of which could play a role in later behavior. A few decades ago, you would see doctors in TV commercials endorsing a particular brand of cigarettes. And many medical doctors smoked. Not today. Today, the evidence is clear. Smoking is the number one cause of preventable health problems and shortened lifespans. Although in the interest of profits, cigarette manufacturers may have suppressed evidence for some time, linking smoking and health problems, eventually the cause-effect relationship became obvious to anyone who wanted to fully investigate the facts. See, that's why I said earlier, for a Christian to smoke is so blatantly wrong, because, you know, it's not only serving any purpose, it is detrimental to your own physical well-being. And nobody can deny that. Nobody can deny that. This article goes on to say, unlike the cause and effect in the example of your eating something and immediately getting sick, the effects of cigarette smoking aren't immediately apparent. It is only years later that many smokers develop lung cancer, heart problems, emphysema, impotency problems, etc. In the same way, after looking at years of accumulated data, we are now recognizing a relationship between violence in the media and social problems. Studies show that people who watch a lot of TV violence not only behave more aggressively, but are more prone to hold attitudes that favor violence and aggression as a way of solving conflicts. These viewers also tend to be less trusting of people and more prone to see the world in a hostile place. Studies show that media violence has a desensitizing effect on viewers. As a result, specific levels of violence becomes more acceptable over time. It then takes more and more graphic violence to shock and hold an audience. And now here is where the problem of the under article lies. Sure, all these cases of strong violence can't be blamed on television, but they can be blamed on violence in society. And here this article explains how, because he goes on to say, history gives us many examples. To cite just one, the Roman circuses started out being a rather tame form of entertainment. But in an effort to excite audiences, violence and rape were introduced in the arena settings. Subsequently, as audiences got used to seeing those things, they then demanded more and more until the circuses eventually became extremely grotesque and barbarian. Next, many or media violence is typically unrealistic, simplistic, glorified, and even presented as humorous. The bang, bang, you are dead scenario that we so often see on television has nothing to do with the reality of death or dying. It's only when we see death firsthand or have a loved one killed that we realize that death in film or on TV bears little resemblance to what we experience in real life. Next, the consequence of killing, especially by the good guys, are seldom shown. Violence and killing are commonly depicted as a ready and even acceptable solution to problems. You see, like you're going into Iraq to blow some people off, and we saw it even on television where people actually show that buildings are blown off because, you know, people are in there. You don't even realize people are in there. The suffering of the people who have to die in this kind of nonsense and madness is hardly ever shown. This article goes on to say, to put it simplistically, problems are solved and the bad guys are all dead. If you only get rid of Saddam Hussein, everything will be better. Well, look at the situation now. I mean, did it get better? I don't think anybody is really believing that. It goes on to say, the unrealistic element of TV and film violence seems to come as a surprise to some. A young gang member who was admitted to a New York ER after being shot seemed amazed to find that getting shot was not only traumatic, but excruciatingly painful. He was blaming the doctors and nurses for his pain, since on TV, getting shot doesn't seem to be all that much of a big of a deal. I mean, this probably person had probably some other mental problems. This article goes on to say, one of the most successful television series in history, Star Trek, was created, produced, and largely written by Gene Roddenberry, whose primary message was peaceful coexistence. In the end, Gene Roddenberry was proud of the message he delivered week after week to millions of people around the world. Earlier, during testimony before Congress, Roddenberry had said, television is the most dangerous force in the world today. So it seems to be pretty much established that there is a connection between the high amount of violence portrayed in movies and in the way it's being portrayed and violence in society. On my last trip to Germany, I picked up this interesting magazine. It's PM Perspektive, or PM Perspective, and this goes into all of these issues, and one of the articles is an article on violence on television, and I could read it to you, but this is in German, so I translated it. I want to read a few excerpts from it. A high amount of TV viewing has an effect on the learning abilities of the viewers. When students learn vocabulary or math in the morning and watch a horror movie in the afternoon, then they are emotionally disturbed by the movie, which in turn removes from their short-term memory brain. In other words, our brain is composed of two components, let's say. One is a short-term and one is a long-term memory. And they say here, if you watch this in the afternoon and you have studied in the morning, what you have studied in the morning is being removed from your short-term memory brain because it doesn't reach now the long-term memory brain. It's not going to be retained. It even goes on to say that when students watch a violent movie in the evening, this affects the functioning of the brain during the sleep because it is known now that the brain still works when a person sleeps. And the article goes on to say someone who watches television for many hours, and we're talking about, you know, extremely violent stuff, becomes desensitized. One gets accustomed to it. But the question is, does this lead to actual violence of the students? That's not that simple. The central role, and that is what we can't overemphasize enough, the central role play the family, the friends, the environment where the children grow up. The conclusion TV makes stupid and violent is not supportable. TV can have a good effect on viewers because it also broadcasts news and educational programs and other good stuff. Balanced Christian living means you make the right choice. Now, you may make a wrong choice in the process, but we are led to the fact here that the parents' role in raising their children is very important. Again, let me say, that's my opinion. Normally, I don't like to state that, but in this case, I want to. My wife and I, having raised two children who are now grown-ups, normally, a strict prohibition of all movie viewing is not the solution. Rather, the parents are to guide the children, and they should allow them to watch movies in their presence, so even if they are not extremely all that good, because bad parts can be discussed and can be evaluated. If parents are too strict, prohibits their teens to watch movies in their home, they will watch the movies somewhere else, without parental guidance, without supervision. The parents thereby have abrogated the golden opportunity of educating and teaching their children what is good and what isn't. And let's not be too righteous. Remember what we said at the beginning, don't be overly righteous. To forbid a movie just because it may have a bad word in it, while it's otherwise profitable, that's not wise. We are not to leave this world and go into a monastery. We are to live in this world, but we are to live as good and shining examples for others. So let's live as the right kind of balance, and let's lead and raise our children and teens by right example. When we complain about violence on television, while at the same time advocating that our troops invade Iraq, we have created an inconsistency. And our kids are quick to notice that. There is a prophecy given in the book of Malachi, chapter 4. I haven't seen Mr. Willis's signal yet, so which means I still have time. He showed me 10 more hours. Malachi chapter 4, beginning in verse 4. It says, "Remember the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded him in Horeb for all Israel, with the statutes and judgments. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord." And notice what Elijah the prophet, the commission given to the church, is supposed to do. He will turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the hearts of the children to their fathers. Family relationships are supposed to be restored. "Lest I come," God says, "and strike the earth with a curse or with utter destruction." Notice what John the Baptist, who came within the spirit of Elijah, did do as a forerunner in Luke chapter 1. How this is being described, how his work is described. In Luke chapter 1, beginning in verse 16. It says, "He will turn many of the children of Israel to the Lord their God." Verse 17. "He will also go before him," before Christ, "in the spirit and power of Elijah, to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children." But now he doesn't say, "and to turn the hearts of the children to the fathers." He is slightly changing this now, and he's saying, "and the disobedient," the children, left to themselves, "to the wisdom of the just." You see, the just, the wisdom the parents should have, and to make ready a people prepared to the Lord. That's the bottom line, to get ready for God, to give accounts, to be able to give accounts to God when he comes back. Now let me quickly give you this test, 10 questions. I've numbered them 1 to 10. These are true or false questions. You can just write down number 1, and then you write down it's either true or false, and then we'll see how good you are doing. First question, 1. The Bible totally prohibits the consumption of alcohol. True or false? 2. The Bible recommends that one smokes at least one cigarette a day. 3. Before you marry, you should have premarital sex with your partner to make sure that you are compatible with him or her. 4. As a parent, you should never allow your children who are of age or your older teens to date, as this could lead to premarital sex. 5. When you get married, you must live together with your parents or parents-in-law in the same house. 7. The greatest cause for divorce is Viagra. 8. There would be no violence and murders in the world if no one were to watch television. 9. Roman circuses became extremely violent because of the excessive use of television. And 10. Some laugh. Good. Family, friends, and peers have absolutely no impact on whether someone will drink too much, smoke, or whether someone engages in premarital sex. So let me quickly ask you, how many of you answered all the questions is true? How many of you answered one of the questions was true? How many of you answered all the questions was false? How many of you didn't participate? All the questions were false. I wanted to give you an assignment. I wanted to say, if you answered one question wrong, you're supposed to listen to the sermon again. But you may still want to do that. But let's do it in balance.